Hey everybody, Filmwax Radio welcomes a new sponsor to the show, Jet Sets, in Long Island City, New York. Jet Sets is a production company that specializes in virtual and augmented reality for pre, live, and post-production. They use state-of-the-art production tools and a render engine to create photorealistic 3D environments for real-time composites. Their system will allow any talent to be placed with any background that you can imagine, both indoor and outdoor, with complete flexibility and freedom. Feel free to contact Jet Sets Studios directly. Go to jetsets.com, JETTSETS.com, for more information. And now on with the show.
This is Barry Levinson, and you're listening to Filmwax Radio.
Hey everybody, this is Adam Shartoff, your host of Filmwax Radio. It is Thursday, April 25th, 2019. This is episode 550 of the podcast. We have two documentary filmmakers on this episode. Old friend of the show, Doug Block, returns for his third visit on the show. And first time on this show, documentary filmmaker Sam Green. Never had Sam on before. How is that possible? Anyway, we rectified that issue, and we have Sam on this show. Sam has co-directed or produced this live documentary event with his partner, Joe Beanie, and together they have made a live documentary experience called A Thousand Thoughts. It's going to be performed tonight. Tonight, if you're free, listen closely, because if you're in New York City and you're free, go tonight to the town hall. Go to their website. You can get tickets and find out more details about the event. But Oscar-nominated filmmakers Sam Green and Joe Beanie have teamed up with the Grammy-winning Kronos Quartet for a wildly creative multimedia performance piece that blends live music and narration with archival footage and film interviews with such prominent artists as Philip Glass, Tanya Tagek, I probably butchered her name, Steve Reich, Wu Man, and Terry Riley. As Green tells the multi-decade and continent-spanning story of the groundbreaking string quartet, Kronos revisits its extensive body of work performing music by George Crumb, Alexandra Vrabelov, and many others. Together on stage, Green and Kronos interact with the stirring cinematic imagery on screen to create an important record, an exploration of late 20th and early 21st century music, transcending the typical live music and film event. This collaboration quickly becomes a meditation on music itself, the act of listening to it closely, the experience of feeling it deeply, and the power that it has to change the world. Doors at 7:30. Show begins at 8 o'clock, again Thursday, April 25th, 2019, at the Town Hall. I'm proud to bring you Sam Green here on Filmwax Radio, and we'll be back with Doug Block and his 20-year-old documentary homepage, available for the first time streaming and on DVD. So hang out for that as well. Here now, Sam Green on Filmwax Radio.
When I was 12 and I first heard a string quartet playing Beethoven's Opus 127, there's me, and then there's music. I have to learn to do that. I'm going to do that.
We're the Kronos Quartet.
What is music? You finish making a note, and that's it. Where is it?
Music is a place.
Music is all about imagination.
You have to play being yourself.
One of the things about the Kronos that I like is that they get inside the music.
The sound of two violins, a viola and a cello, is an amazing sound. It expresses something about life that no other sound I've ever heard does.
A screening of...
I actually was at a funeral.
Oh, I'm sorry.
My old friend Bill Siegel.
Oh, yeah.
Underground.
Right. And you said Chicago. I should have... Oh, thanks. Yeah. That's right. I did want to bring you on in part to talk about Bill. Because he was such a mentor and meant so much to so many people, right? But you were particular. You collaborated with him on one of your documentaries.
Yeah.
And when you said Chicago, I should have realized who you were referring to. How did you meet him?
We met in the early 90s. We both were researchers on a very ill-fated documentary series about Muhammad Ali.
Makes sense. Again, he did the trials of Muhammad Ali, right?
We met Leon Gass there. He was working on it. And it was this completely bonkers project where these two British, I wouldn't even call them filmmakers, advertised, guys who made ads, connected with Ali somehow and got the rights to make this documentary about him. And they got millions of dollars from a Japanese publishing company, opened a office in Soho, and had no idea what they were doing. So this one-hour documentary slowly got bigger and bigger until it was a 12-part series. The crazy thing, I didn't know at the time that it was just insane, but what they did is they hired the editors before they shot anything. So all these editors were just sitting around, like, waiting for stuff to be shot. It didn't make any sense at all. But
were they on the clock? You know?
Yeah.
That's bizarre.
Anyway, it was a great job. It was a great job for me right out of college.
Yeah.
And was one of my early documentary sort of formative experiences.
So that series on Muhammad Ali, obviously he was alive. And this was separate from the trials of Muhammad Ali. That was later. That was later.
That was what Bill made. Bill, we both had like very deep Ali interests. We called them hobby horses, and one of Bill's was that. And that
themes that keep subjects that keep coming back
came back, you know, with him in that film.
Right, and Leon did The King.
Yeah,
which is another lauded
for sure.
Those two films, I would say, were the two that really kept
big
gotten
Ali
the most
movies,
accolades and attention and.
Leon, I think executive produced Bill's movie.
Oh, okay.
That one, yeah.
When Muhammad Ali died about 4 years ago, 3 or 4 years ago, right? I reached out to both Bill and Leon.
Yeah.
To, you know, which I was a little bit, I'm always a little cautious, but I like to do that because, usually with somebody in the film world, if they pass away, I try to, like with Bill now, and reaching out to you, although we had already been in the works, but... But Muhammad Ali is like yourselves, for some reason, just meant so much to me. You know, my age growing up with him, you know, being one of these ubiquitous icons. And so when he died, I wanted to get on Leon or Bill. And Leon responded sooner, I guess. Mm-hmm. I don't remember. But so unfortunately, I think I was going to still try to get Bill on as well. But it didn't happen. Anyway, so how was the ceremony?
It was... You know, I mean, you can't say something like that. Like, it was great.
It can be.
Well, people spoke. Cathartic. But anybody dying at 55 is just a tragedy. I had teenage kids. It's just such a bad situation that it's hard for it to be anything but that. But people spoke, and he was evoked, and that was nice. It was good to see people.
I'm sorry. Yeah. Sorry for that. And as someone who's the same age, with a teenage son, it does.
Yeah.
No, it sounds horrible.
Yeah.
Don't forget, there's a contact information. Yeah. Anyway, and so Bill, what other things would be known for things that he had his hands on?
Well, he made the, like we said, the Ali documentary, and then we made Weather Underground together.
Right.
He was working on a new that came out in 2003.
Okay.
And we had really become friends doing this. Working on this series and continue to be friends. And at some point, we both had an interest in radical history. And at some point, I said to him, hey, you want to work on a movie about the Weather Underground together? And, you know,
yeah,
we did.
That sounded like right up his alley. What is it about? stories of our the our radical history, or of just radical history in general.
For me, I grew up in the 80s, and I lived in Michigan, and there was always a kind of like the vapors of the 60s were still around.
Yeah, sure.
And but growing up in the 80s as a teenager, you know, you looked around the world and you thought, how did the 60s become the 80s? It kind of didn't make sense. So for me, in an almost self-interested way, I was trying to make sense of what happened to that time. I mean, that is what drew me to the Weather Underground story, because in a way, we know a ton about the 60s and 68 and flowers in your hair and stuff like that, but
Woodstock and
very few people, much less attention has been paid to the end of that period and how that period became the 70s and how really the 60s lasted into, you know, 1975 or 77 in a way, what we think of as the 60s.
Oh,
so
very much, right.
The Weather Underground is kind of a key or a vehicle through which to explore that.
I see. Yeah. It is a part also on a personal level of your youth, and it was going on maybe through exploring some of these things that were happening that weren't necessarily on your radar because you were more concerned with watching cartoons or hanging out and collecting comic books, whatever it was, you know. But that this was going on in the world during that time.
For
and
sure.
Kind of looking at it now, this is part of your story in a way, you know, too. And
it's true.
I get that interest. I think I have similar interests, you know. So I remember seeing that when it came out, The Weather Underground, you know.
So Bill Ayers and Bernadine Dorn were at the funeral, you know, the two people from The Weather Underground, and they were, we went to the Oscars with them, and that was really fun, and they spoke at the funeral and talked about remembering hearing us rehearsing our speeches, because back then, I don't know if it's still the case, but back then, if you're nominated, they tell you you've got to write a speech, because if you win and you get up there and you haven't written something,
prepared.
You're fucked.
Yeah,
so, so we wrote these great speeches sort of knowing we weren't going to win, which was gave us great freedom, and Bill wrote this like very revolutionary thing, you know, really, really like kick-ass speech. So I'd forgotten all about that. That was a nice
Was that one
memory.
Of the Billy Crystal years?
Yeah, I think so.
Those were, I think, the best. Overall, I should say. As far as hosts go, he sort of, you know, it's appealing right now, that the idea of, I think, the bringing him back again because of all this stuff that just went on.
Yeah.
For those who don't know who are listening, the Weather, just because we were talking about the Weather Underground, I'm just going off on spontaneously, but it was a radical group. It wasn't very big, was it?
No.
But they were just, you know, they were radical, progressive, political leftists, and who felt like they needed to make more reactionary noise.
There were young people who had protested against the war and racism for many years in the 60s, and by the end of the 60s, the war was just getting bigger and worse, and they felt like nonviolent protest wasn't working. So what they did is they went underground, sort of disappeared from sight, and did a series of bombings. They never hurt anybody. It was symbolic, but, you know, they put a bomb in the Capitol. They put a bomb in the Pentagon, a lot of buildings like that, and they do communique. So it was kind of like, they called it armed propaganda, which in a way it was. And they were not a big group. It was a couple hundred people, but they really struck a nerve, you know, a cultural nerve, because the FBI chased them for years and never got them. And they were sort of like these Bonnie and Clyde, like, you know, outlaw hippie kids. So there was a kind of romantic aura to it.
Was that your first documentary?
No, I had made a documentary before that called The Rainbow Man, John 3:16. And it's just a movie I made out for complete fun, not thinking about it at all. And I came up with a movie of the worst length for a movie you could ever get. 42 minutes long.
Yeah, right.
Which it's not a short and it's not a long.
It's a long short or a short.
Well, somebody once told me it's a schlong.
It's a schlong. It's really funny.
And I thought that was it was one of the Sundance programmers. They have that term.
Yeah, that's why they're at Sundance.
We started joking about how there could be schlong film, you know, like the New York Schlong Film Festival and the New York Jewish Schlong Film Festival.
Right. Schmucks only, you know.
But anyway, so I made that, and that actually, as to my surprise, it it screened at Sundance and it screened all over. So
as a short?
As a feature with another long short with it.
Well, that makes sense.
Yeah.
So in the festivals back then anyway.
Yeah.
I don't know if that would happen today, but it might.
They paired it with another sort of similar film that was long too.
Yeah. But I forget who I was talking to just the other day. It was probably, you know, at a party because they, you know, like Motto and Elsewhere. A few of these, a lot of Roger Raw, all these guys had their parties. And I was talking to somebody about it and they were like, they didn't understand the short. And I'm on the New York Film Festival screen committee. I'm just mentioning that because I had to watch 100 shorts.
Ooh.
And but I had a nice period of time to do it. And there were a lot of very good shorts in there. The thing you hear from the majority of American festivals is they like that 7 minute. Oh, you know who I was talking to? I was talking to Chris Hedges, and she, I guess, was, we were talking about shorts at one point and she was saying, oh yeah, because she never really had to think about that. First of all, they don't make shorts, the two of them. And so, you know, but they just, I guess, were helping or producing somebody or I don't know. And she was like, yeah, I just realized, I just found out I was talking to somebody and they said the 7 minutes is, you don't want to go or something. I think it was her, but you know,
I think now that's probably the case.
Yeah. The thing is still you make a short for the length it's supposed to be. You have to.
You make any film for the length it should be.
Right.
For sure.
Yeah.
And that should, it's funny because the Rainbow Man, the movie I made, should have been 42 minutes. That was just right. I wasn't thinking about it, which was the best way to do it.
Yeah.
And it got out in the world.
Right. Sure. So, and it probably created some opportunities.
Oh, yeah, for sure.
Because of that, right? And also, it's funny you say it was too long for a short, but it was also too short for broadcast length. So if it was another 10 minutes, it might have been, you know, you'd have to somehow figure that out, I guess, if you're trying to do that.
Right? Yeah. That was that movie, It was 1997, so it was like a different era, but it got on one of the airlines was screening, having independent films on, you know, this like...
It's nuts.
Yeah, and...
That was before they had the individualized...
Yeah, it was like in first class, they would have something, you know, like indie films or something. And when I made this film, I didn't think about length, and I never thought about licensing anything either. And, you know, the Rainbow Man was this guy who would show up at televised sporting events wearing a rainbow-colored wig, and he got famous by doing this.
Oh, right.
And so the film is made out of tons of TV clips of him on shows. None of it licensed at all. So...
How'd you get it?
How did I get the stuff?
Yeah.
Oh, that's another long story. All right. But, so anyway, this was the airline got in touch with me to...
Mm-hmm.
Show this, and I was like, sure, because it was something like $1,000 or something. Sure. And I just thought, strange. I hope nobody watches this, which I don't think anybody did because nobody ever sued me.
Right. Oh, interesting. Right. Because of, you know, you can show it often festivals.
Yeah.
It's not an issue, but once you're talking about, you know, where there's a
money and contracts.
Right, commerce going on, and then rights have to be paid and all. That's right. Oh, that's amazing. That you could have gotten away with that, right?
It's a different world.
Yeah, 20 years ago. And there was also a fraction of the festivals that there are now, too. A
fraction
of
the films.
And films. Well, I guess, of course.
So many more films.
Right. Well, you know, you can make them, as we, you know. Anybody can call themselves a film.
Yeah,
film.
It's true.
You
know,
to some degree. Where did you study? Did you?
I studied film at the journalism school at UC Berkeley.
Oh, okay.
I went there. I was going to be a newspaper reporter.
Really?
And I was signing up for classes for the second year, and I had a friend who said, "Hey, you want to take this documentary class? I hear it's really easy."
So Which makes sense.
Yeah. So I said, "Oh, sure, I'll take it." And I didn't know Marlon Riggs was the teacher. I didn't know who he was, and I just literally like that changed my life.
It just turned on a light.
Yeah, switch. It was so fun. Making films was fun. Writing for me was really hard.
Right.
Films was fun and collaborative, and I had a facility for it. Mm-hmm. I mean, it seemed like I like doing this, and I seemed like I can do it. And also, I had never really seen any experimental documentaries. I just sort of knew the world of PBS, boring PBS documentaries. So people would pass around tapes. It was almost like the Soviet Union or something, VHS tapes.
Yeah.
I saw Cirque du Soleil, and I'd never seen anything like that, and just was totally mesmerized by it. So.
Yeah, right. Right, this very different, where there was this whole world going on of experimental films.
Experimental documentary, especially.
Nonfiction, let's call it.
Whatever. I had not known that world existed, and to me that was just... This is my place. You know, I really like that. So.
And were you trying to figure out if you could make a living doing that?
Hell no. I was...
Didn't care. You were young.
Twice. Yeah. And I all through my 20s, I was weighed down by this big existential question. What am I going to be?
Mm-hmm.
And sometime towards the end of my 20s, I just had this epiphany where I thought, I'm not going to... figure that out. I'm just going to do what I enjoy doing.
Mm-hmm.
So I'm going to make this film about the Rainbow Man. That was my first film. And I did it and it got out there and I thought, wow, this is kind of fun. I'm going to make another film.
Mm-hmm.
I'm not a filmmaker, but I'm just going to make another film. And I made The Weather Underground and that got even more out there. And I've tried to keep going with that, but it gets harder as you get older. You know,
yeah,
you sort of...
Right.
Take on this thing you do as an identity.
And you have to fill out tax forms, and you have to fill out...
You got
to
say you're a filmmaker.
Right. Yeah. And you have to fill out grant forms.
Right.
And you have to do... And, you know, eventually, whether you know it or not, you are the filmmaker
that
you're writing
on
down.
On the form, you can't say, occupation, guy who's doing what
making
he wants.
Films. Yeah, right. Following my... not musical.
Bliss.
Thank you. So, yeah, so it seems like by your second one, and you now have actually, because Weather Underground, that got, obviously was out in theaters.
Yeah.
But did it get a broadcast?
Yeah, it was on PBS.
Wow, so that's pretty...
Slightly cleaner version was on PBS.
Mm-hmm. Yeah. Was it on like a, not POV, right?
It was on Independent Lens.
Independent Lens, yeah. Right. Lois Vossen, who's, I'm sure you know quite well, she's a real, she's become now, we have a regular thing we do every year now. We've done two of them, so now I can say that.
Really? Oh, great.
Well, she comes on to talk about the new season.
Oh,
yeah, so
excellent.
She is a great guest.
She's awesome.
Yeah. You run a company? And it's pretty, she's very enthusiastic and funny.
They had just given Bill money to make a new film, Bill Siegel.
ITVS, you mean?
Yeah, with Lois, about Voice of America.
Mm. So he wasn't sick.
He had a heart attack.
He had a heart attack.
Yeah.
Wow. And what was it going to be about? The film?
Voice of America.
Voice of America?
The propaganda, American propaganda.
Yeah, right. What happened after, what happened subsequently to Weather Underground?
What now happened after Weather Underground?
Well, I mean, like, you know, now you're kind of figuring out this is a career, so
I guess
I may as well own it.
Yeah, I mean, after that I was making a kind of experimental documentary about utopia called Utopia in Four Movements, and I really loved Fast, Cheap, and Out of Control, the Errol Morris film where there's several characters, and it never explains why they're grouped together, and you as a viewer
try to make those
connections yourself. I really liked that.
Yeah.
So I thought I'm going to make this... a film about utopia and the 20th century focusing on four different stories. And I'm not going to sort of weave them together myself, but hopefully people will make something of it.
Mm-hmm.
And so I shot these four pieces and I put it together and I showed it as a rough cut to people. And people said, this makes no sense whatsoever. And I was completely crushed.
I'm sorry to interrupt you.
Yeah.
Were they separate vignettes?
Yeah,
or were
they were all separate stories. Okay. One was about Esperanto, the language Esperanto.
Yeah, okay, I had to read about that. Yeah.
One was about the world's largest shopping mall. One was about an American revolutionary fugitive living in Cuba.
Mm-hmm.
And the other was about something called forensic anthropology. So granted, they don't obviously connect.
Mm-hmm.
But to me, they really did. And I expected people to get it, and they didn't, so... I was really stuck.
Yeah.
I didn't know what to do. And I'd never made a film with voiceover. I came from a when I was coming up, voiceover was really scorned.
Frowned upon, right?
Yeah, it was like, oh, because that had been the past, you know, these bad Voice of God documentaries.
Right, right, yeah.
So I was stuck, and somebody asked me to do a presentation about this project.
Mm-hmm.
You know, I was in the middle of editing it, and I said, okay, what I'll do is I'll show some clips and I'll talk. And that sounds kind of boring, so I'll get my friend Dave Surf, who made music for Weather Underground, to make some music. So it'll be like a fancy lecture.
Mm-hmm.
And I did that, and it was really fun. And it also, weird thing is, it worked just the way I wanted the movie to work.
Mm-hmm.
People got it.
Mm-hmm.
The connection between these four stories. So I kind of... that registered, and then somebody else at another film festival said, will you give that talk about your film project? So mm-hmm. I said, sure, and we made it even more sort of like fancy with live music, and that worked super great too. It did what I wanted this film about Utopia to do, and I thought, I've never heard of a live documentary, but maybe that's, you know, I said every film has its length. In some ways, maybe every film has its ideal form too, and mm-hmm. this one seemed appropriate for a lot of different reasons, and mm-hmm. so we showed it to the programmers at Sundance. We went to LA and sort of did it in an empty theater, me and Dave Surf, and they programmed it, so it's like, cool, okay, it'll show at Sundance. I never had thought beyond that, like, what do you do with a live documentary? And we toured around for a couple of years showing this, and it was so much fun, and mm-hmm. it really worked, and it opened my eyes to a lot of things about performance, the performing arts world. You know, this was in the film world at festivals, but also in the performing arts world.
Well, sure, right, because there's the live components to it. And did you find it hard to, like, market this thing, to figure out how to communicate what you're trying to do to potential ticket buyers?
The challenge was that, yeah, you're like, is it a movie? Is it a lecture, you know, like, right. What is this? But the upside was people seemed to be very interested and eager for a kind of film thing that was different. And I think all festivals now have this existential quandary. If you can just watch this stuff on the internet, why should I come to a film festival?
Or a movie theater.
Yeah. And this was definitely something you could not see on the internet. So in a lot of ways, I think for festivals... and festivals still have this a little bit, you know, that like a live event is cool.
Mm-hmm.
So it was hard but easy at the same time. It was much easier than I thought. Mm-hmm. A lot of people got in touch with us to do that show.
Oh, great. Right. And that was when, how far back?
2010.
Okay, so not that long ago.
Not that long
ago. But you've been doing it since.
Yeah.
Because this is something that's obviously really...
I just was really taken with this form, and each time I've made a live cinema piece, I've been trying to use it a little better, and, you know, there's such powerful tools there, so I'm sort of exploring how to use them, and I feel like
right.
the last one, I really got it.
Mm-hmm. Which was?
It's called 1,000 Thoughts, and it's a live cinema piece about the Kronos Quartet.
Mm-hmm. All right.
Famous.
Yep.
Classical group, and they play the soundtrack live.
So you connect, obviously.
Yeah.
That's amazing. But they like doing that kind of thing too, right?
Yeah. They're up for doing weird stuff, and they've done a lot of soundtracks. So what is it?
I just got Penny Marshall passed away. I just heard.
Wow.
Yeah.
Keep that in the podcast. That's big.
Yeah, that just came to my, somebody, a friend just.
You must have Laverne and Shirley. As like a old memory.
I hated that show.
Really?
Well, it was it was part of the wallpaper of my age too, growing up. But I remember Lenny and Squiggin, who would have thought that, you know, Lenny would have become like, you know, one of the great performers and entertainers of my age, Michael McKean, you know, who liked one of my tweets or something like that once. And I thought, okay, I've made it, totally. Well, sorry that we lost Penny Marshall.
Yeah.
So sad.
She was interesting, you know, who would have thought
in real time
she would have gone on to have a career as a director.
Right. Yeah. And a really successful one
too,
right? Even though she seems like I guess she did stop making films for a while. Right. And her ex-husband, Rob Reiner, is one of the, right? Yeah. Another TV sitcom actor who also, and then who was the other one, of course, was Ron Howard.
Ron Howard, for sure.
The three of them all around the same time.
Yeah. Right, Fonzie early 80s. Did not make a lot of movies after that.
Well, as an actor, you mean?
No, I mean as a director.
As a film, did he direct anything?
No.
Maybe one, maybe something. But he's certainly also flourished on TV shows.
Yeah.
Like Arrested Development and this new show with the, I'm going to forget his name, but the guy from Saturday Night Live who is a contract killer, assassin, and he gets roped into taking acting classes and he falls in love with being an actor.
Oh.
And, you know? And Henry Winkler is the teacher of the class, and
that
so,
sounds really good.
Yeah, it. Well, yeah. I mean,
I'm hopeless about TV.
But Henry Winkler is very funny. You know, it's very against type.
Yeah,
against the Fonzie and the whole and his whole clean cut kind of Henry Winkler's, reputation, whatever. Anyway, rest in peace.
Yeah,
you know, Penny Marshall. We're talking about the Kronos Quartet, and that they like to collaborate. And
they like to
and they're obviously an experimental classical group. They're not just a class, right? They're not just doing classical pieces.
It sort of transcends classical.
A little bit,
I mean,
right.
They come out of a classical tradition, but
sure.
They're sort of like Muhammad Ali in that they they transcended their discipline and brought a lot of attention to it.
Mm-hmm.
You know, they became Muhammad Ali was larger than boxing, and Kronos Quartet is the same way.
Yeah, interesting.
Ask anybody on the street, you know, most people who know Kronos Quartet couldn't name another classical quartet.
Mm-hmm. Right. Oh, yeah, they did that album with Elvis Costello, so all that time back, you know. That's, I think, another... I remember discovering them through that.
Yeah.
Years, like 20 years ago when they were...
It's funny, a lot of people know them just through their soundtrack. So they're like, oh, Requiem for a Dream, they did that.
They did. Oh, I didn't realize. Okay.
That's their big hit.
Okay. Darren Aronofsky.
Yeah.
So this becomes this thing of yours. Is it a practical? Would it be just easier sometimes to? I mean, one thing I wanted to say before when you were talking about how you've been able to, what's the word? Not improve upon, but well, it is improving upon, but it's just also
further
being able
explore,
to
fine hone
down, and is that the first project, which was the 2004 you said or something?
2010.
2010. Oh, much more recent. Was that was the Kronos one?
No, the first one
was the most
was
recent
the
one you did.
Utopia.
Yeah. Utopia, exactly. But that was incidental, or you had made it as a conventional experimental film, let's say, and then rejiggered it with retrofitted it into this new thing, which you didn't even know what it was at first, right? But it kind of developed into something organically. Yeah. So then you were able to build off that experience with the subsequent works,
exactly.
Right? And then gauge how audiences were responding, how you were responding, how, you know, things
what ideas
fit together.
Would work. So I did piece about Buckminster Fuller with the band Yo La Tengo.
Okay.
And that was great because it was really interesting to work with a band that people know. You know, and that was part of what I'm trying to do with this is to make a kind of charged atmosphere in the room that you wouldn't get if you were just watching it with your laptop. And so it was really interesting to see when they would come on. They have a lot of fans.
Yeah.
Musicians have, people love bands. And they would come into the room and you could feel a kind of charge in the air.
Mm-hmm.
So it's interesting to realize you can heighten the experience by working with a band that people know and love. And not saying that in a star fucking way, but just in the mechanics of it, that this helps to add a kind of specialness in the air that you're seeing this band you love. So, you know, that was a big epiphany for me. And then Kronos Quartet, similar, a lot of people love them, but having them be the subject and playing the music is a kind of meta level to it that I'd not done before. And it really, that I feel like makes this piece definitely the best thing I've made of all the films I've made, because it's conceptually, it's strong, I think.
Mm. And how frequently do you, and by the way, Yo La Tengo seems another group that likes to really collaborate.
Yeah,
I know.
And do weird stuff.
And weird stuff.
And movies, too.
And shake, right, and then not, you know, right, and take risks, yeah. artistic risks, yeah. et cetera, which is exciting. You know.
So with the Kronos piece, we premiered it at Sundance this year. So
right.
2018.
We can still say that, even though probably when people hear this, yeah. it might be the
next
last
year.
Yeah. It might be during Sundance, even.
We premiered it at Sundance last year, and we've done about 15 shows.
Okay.
And it's funny because a group like Kronos Quartet books things years in advance. So we're now booking shows for 2021
mm-hmm.
and 2022.
Yeah,
so
it's amazing.
We'll, it's about one or two shows a month, which is great. It's not like rock and roll touring where you're in a bus going around. You fly off to somewhere, you do a show, you come back. I love doing it. And sometimes people say, you were sort of said this earlier,
uh-huh.
wouldn't it be easier if you just made a movie and people could watch it on Netflix? Yes, it's true. But actually, the going out and presenting a movie and being there is one of my favorite parts of the process.
Right.
So this really accentuates that. You're always there at the screenings. You're always part of it. And I like that, actually.
Right. And this is a live event. This is
yeah.
not just a movie. It's,
right.
It's right. It's a component that the screening is, or the projection of the film is part of that, is a one component of it, even though it might be the most central one, you know, it sounds like.
Yeah. Also, it pays good.
It does. Right.
The film business, you know, the bottom dropped out of the film business.
Yeah.
Unless have a movie that's making millions of dollars, you're not mm-hmm. usually making anything. Mm-hmm. And this performing arts, in the performing arts world, people still get paid.
Mm-hmm.
There hasn't been a kind of revolution. Everything has gone digital and the bottom drops out of the economy of it. So...
Well, now that you bring that up, who is the audience, generally speaking?
We did a big show at the Ace Hotel Theater in L.A. a week ago.
Mm-hmm.
And I'd say it's half film people. No, let's say a third film people, a third Kronos fans, and a third performing arts people who would go to see a dance thing or,
right.
you know.
Sure, sure.
Right. It was put on by UCLA's performing arts presenter. You mm-hmm. know, the people who would do ballet or a talk by, you know, Leonard Nimoy or something like that. So if it were
I
still
would
alive.
Love to go to, okay, I was going to say that. That'd be pretty good.
So, you know, it's a mixed audience. It's some film people, but
right.
a lot of other people, too.
Yeah, but people that are definitely interested in the yeah. live experience. Yeah, that makes sense. At Kronos, the real fans would love to see something out of the typical context
yeah.
of sitting in a concert hall.
You also learn a lot about Kronos, too. They've had a 45-year career, and most people don't know a lot about...
Is it still, like, original members?
Three of them are.
How many are... It's a quartet.
It's a quartet.
So there's four. I'm pretty fast on my feet. Thanks for highlighting
that. Always one of my favorite questions. How many people are in the Kronos
quartet? Yeah. At last count, four.
Tends to be four.
Yeah. Yeah, what do they do if they want to add somebody? They're stuck. And interesting. Are there any more artists that you kind of are excited to explore working with?
Well,
or
I always really wanted to, and I tried hard to do this a couple of years ago, work with Dan Deacon, who I love. Mm-hmm. Do you know Dan Deacon?
No,
he's an electronic musician.
Okay.
He is an amazing live performer. He, you know, like most electronic musicians are like behind a laptop, really dull. And he's somebody who can get a crowd, like a huge crowd going,
mm-hmm.
you know, and just is a masterful performer. So I thought he would be great. But
Does he have a big following too?
He's got a huge following and he's super busy and in demand. So.
Okay. Yeah. So we'll see. But you have like at these dates with the Kronos
yeah.
guys.
I also really wanted to... Oh, at first, before I decided to do a live documentary out of the... Turn the...
Utopia
into a live documentary, I thought I'd get somebody to narrate it.
Mm-hmm.
And I really was hoping to get Old Dirty Bastard to narrate it. And he died.
Oh, right. The former...
Wu-Tang.
Well, the rap star.
Yeah.
Right, he was one of the Wu-Tang Clan. Yeah. Again, and then those guys also do that, right? They collaborate with...
Yeah.
Jim Jarmusch,
yeah.
early a long time ago on Ghost Dog,
yep.
and since then, interesting, right? Where you find the different artists. But
yeah.
But
Johnny Greenwood is good, great with movie stuff. Mm-hmm.
Be interesting to get a some country group that are willing to do something like that, right? You know, just for a very different to take on it.
Yeah.
Or, you know, approach. That's true. So with doing those types of things, though, they pay. The other thing that does pay for documentary filmmakers is as you experience with Weather Underground, is the broadcast. It's the best way because, of course, millions of people see your film. Or I guess nowadays, it's not just broadcast. It's also the
Netflix.
The Netflix platform, if you can get through that, into that small group of filmmakers, that can be very...
Although I heard...
Lucrative.
I saw a breakdown of somebody getting paid $1 million by Netflix and where it all went. Not that much went into his pocket.
Are you talking about because investors had to be paid
investors
back?
Investors and costs.
Taxes.
And, just stuff like that. I mean, it...
Yeah.
It sounds like a huge windfall, but...
Well, the ideal one is when they just pay for you to make the film, but hopefully it's your film, your idea, and something you wanted to make. They're not just their idea.
Yeah.
Well, I assume that doesn't really happen. But that mostly you go to Netflix, you get a meeting, you pitch it, and then they say, okay, we'll actually produce this.
Yeah, sometimes they'll do that for sure.
You know, they did that with I think Heidi and
Rachel's My ideas last. Are always too weird to do stuff like that, though.
Right. And what I'm saying is by pursuing this, but I understand it's an exciting project.
Yeah.
You are making money, so therefore you don't need to do that, but that does discount. Is there a plan I'm sure you must get inspirations for more conventional documentary projects. I guess it could work for both potentially, right?
Although it's a little weird because I've noticed what works in a live context doesn't translate directly into a regular movie. You can't just take it and move it over, film it, and then there's certain things that work and they wouldn't work otherwise. So they're I haven't really taken any of my live cinema pieces and made them regular movies, but I am I just finished this Kronos thing and I'm starting to work on new things, and most of them are traditional documentary ideas. So I want to go back and forth. I'm not wedded to one or the other. I mean, it always, to me, feels like the form of the project, the nature of the project comes out of the subject.
Mm-hmm. Right. Yeah. So it's much more of an organic.
Yeah. And this last, the Kronos piece, one of the reasons I think it turned out so good is I worked with Joe Beany, who edited Herzog's movies for a million years, and just really good filmmaker, really good editor. Mm-hmm. So we worked together on that and are going to work on some of these new ideas. Yeah.
Where did you meet him?
I met him. I was at an advisor to Sundance Documentary Editing Lab, and he was too. And he gave a talk about cinema and his ideas of cinema, and I just loved him. He was very radical in his thinking, and that appealed to me. So we became friends, and then at some point I said, hey, you want to work on this weird live thing I'm doing? And I think the idea really appealed to him, because when you're editing a live cinema piece, you're really editing in an extra dimension.
Mm-hmm.
You're editing what's on the screen, but then you're also editing what's in the room too. Sometimes you want the viewer to be completely engrossed with what's on the screen, but sometimes you want them to be aware of what's happening in the room. So you kind of toggle their attention back and forth.
Meaning like the quartet or the musician or you, because you're narrating?
Yeah, I'm narrating. Mm-hmm. And with this piece, for example, we take early on, I invoke John Cage, the...
Yeah, I was going to bring him up.
...experimental composer. And as a way to get everybody to spend 30 seconds just listening to the room. So the lights go on, silence, and people just listen, and you think, it's silence. But if you really listen to silence, it's the fan, it's people coughing, it's people shifting in their seats. And it's sort of a funny moment, but I think it's actually a really important moment in getting people to tune their ears up a little and to lean in. Because normally with a film, you engage very passively with it. You sit back, especially with sound, because films are mixed so well now and they're so sweetened, and you can just sit there and the movie will wash over you. You don't have to do anything.
Mm-hmm.
And that's actually very enjoyable to do that. But with this movie, I hope people will actually sit up and listen in an engaged way. And so this little John Cage exercise gets people to engage.
What's more exhilarating than being in a symphony hall or in a some sort of theater like that and hearing the musicians warm up?
Yeah.
that incredible sound.
Yeah.
That, you know, is only about 10 seconds yeah. long, maybe not even 10 seconds, and you hear it and it's thrilling.
Yeah. It's true.
It has nothing to do with the performance per right. se, but it is in of itself, right?
It's sort of very similar in a way to the lights going down in a cinema. It's that
right.
same
well, it used to where like, what used to feel that way when you first when you would see a movie every as a kid, maybe every
yeah.
couple of months, and you'd get that exciting feeling. Now I don't know about you, but I yearn for that, but it doesn't happen too much when the lights go down anymore. But the other thing I was thinking about as you were speaking, not that I wasn't paying attention, of
no.
course. Was the photographer, there was just a documentary, Winogrand?
Gary Winogrand.
Gary yeah. Winogrand, and how he had all the, I don't know if they're called practice, toss-off shots at uh-huh. the beginning of the negative, right? At the beginning of your role, because you're taking pictures, I don't know, the younger listeners will know what I'm talking about. But when you put a spool of film in your camera back in the day, right, it would take a bunch of moving your shutter
yeah.
forward,
yeah, yeah,
taking a picture, moving your shutter. So you were sure you would get to
yeah.
a proper full photo.
That so wasn't exposed.
That
yeah.
was, right. So you, exactly, right. Because when you're putting the
film,
right, when you're putting the film into and feeding it in, you're going to lose the very beginning. So he would have all these images
mm.
and they were often looking down. Do you know what I'm talking about? So,
because yeah.
he would be pointing the camera down at his feet,
yeah.
and there would be like shadows, and sometimes his daughter would be sitting on his shoulder because huh. he became a dad late in life,
yeah.
and he would take his daughter on these walks, and he would take pictures, and it became this whole, I think it actually became a show,
huh.
those images.
Wow.
But he had, of course, thousands of undeveloped film roles, and that's
yeah.
what he's known for. Like, one of the things was that he just was so prolific, and
yeah.
made so, and that he had, you know, countless rolls of film that were never developed
yeah.
in his lifetime. So anyway, but I remember this being interesting when it brought on, I talked to the filmmaker who made that.
Sasha.
That's yeah. right. Fryer Waters, right?
I'm still.
Or Waters that, Fryer.
That movie is on my list to watch.
Yeah,
I have
yeah.
a long list that gets longer all the time, but.
Well, if it plays in a movie theater for some weird reason, I don't see why. I don't see how it could, right? Again, but it's just.
Yeah. It's one of the Academy. I get all these
DVDs. Oh, right,
DVDs,
your screeners.
So
yeah, sure. They I still send them out like that?
It's funny because I can't play DVDs. I have no way to play DVDs.
Oh, you don't?
No, I don't have a DVD player and my computer doesn't have a...
Well, they have these really inexpensive
yeah.
external DVD. I have yeah. one and I just pulled it out of the drawer because I wanted to actually put a CD in.
Uh-huh.
And like download it to my computer. Yeah. I realized, how do I do this? I give my kid my old MacBook. I could borrow that and
yeah.
then put it on a USB. It's like you download it onto the computer or another computer.
Yeah.
Put in a USB, you know.
Yeah, there you go.
Disk, whatever, memory stick, and then copy it onto that, and then take that out and put copy. It's ludicrous.
I know. You could have just bought it on iTunes or probably on YouTube, actually.
Well, I do that, yeah. I do that because I love listening to music too, and
yeah.
You know, I get a, I was at a party. You know Larry Fessenden?
Yeah,
you do.
I know who he is. Okay. I don't know him.
He's a producer. He does
yeah.
a lot of genre. You know.
Yeah.
But he has this annual party, and I was just there because it was like a holiday party, and in walks one of my favorite you know musicians, like you know that I'm sure I know I was the only one who knew who he was because mm-hmm. he's not known.
Uh-huh.
That. He's also a really great painter, and he was signed for a minute years ago, like 20 years ago, on Peter Gabriel's Real World label.
Hmm.
For what reason, I'm not sure, because he's, I guess in everywhere else in the world, he's a world art music artist. He's anyway, but he's so prolific, and he's so great a musician, and I've seen him play a bunch of times, and he does a lot at City Winery and other, you know, small venues, and he tours, I guess, some degree, I don't know. Anyway, so I got to talk to him and just say, and I have one of your harmonicas because you dropped it on the floor during a show once. I was standing up front, and I said, I'm going to keep it as a joke. And you said, yeah, it's yours. So I was like, kind of, I have it. But he agreed to, he wants to do a podcast. And he, so he was excited to meet and to do the podcast. Yeah. So I'm going over to his place in the East Village on Thursday.
Oh, cool.
And
who is it? What's his name?
Joseph Arthur. Oh, yeah, he's terrific. Just terrific.
Huh.
Yeah, so I dug out, because I used to work in the music industry, so I had tubs of CDs that are sitting in, you know, in a closet, and I was digging out my copies of his CDs because I wanted to bring them over. Anyway, but he would be a great collaborator too. Huh. He's also collaborates with a lot of different musicians and uh-huh. likes to, I think, take risks and do things mm-hmm. that are, you know, out of the ordinary, you know, just, or I'm just explaining it pretty poorly, but you yeah. know what I'm saying? He's just, might be an interesting collaborator. Joseph Arthur. Yeah. He's been around a long time.
Hmm.
You know, I think he's one of those guys that a lot of musicians know who yeah. is, I think, you know, and because of his collaborations and because he's just been such a road warrior or whatever. Anyway, this is kind of exciting for what I do that I can do that, you know, or those experiences
yeah.
happen. You know,
yeah.
and I learned so much during the course of these conversations myself. So it's very gratifying, you know. So that's next. So I guess, do you find yourself, you sort of seem like you're somewhat plugged into things. I remember a couple of years back you were hosting the...
Cinema Eye.
Cinema Eye Honors.
Yeah.
Which they usually have their party right up the block here, right?
Yeah, exactly.
Don't yeah. they? Right at the... At the Polish dance.
Yeah, right down there.
Whatever
yeah.
it is, that building. Yeah. That strange building.
I forgot about that.
Yeah.
Yeah, I mean, I lived in San Francisco for 20 years.
Oh.
And I moved here 8 years ago okay. to New York.
Oh, I see. Oh.
And I love New York. You mm-hmm. know, I'm in some ways a newcomer still
mm-hmm. Mm-hmm.
with the newcomers, you know, like, yeah, I'll come over and say hi to you on the Upper West Side. You know, just like,
mm-hmm.
I remember doing that with Jack.
Jack Lechner. How did you first meet him?
I met him in San Francisco a million years ago.
Oh, okay. Was he living there at the time?
No, he was there for a film financing conference called IFCON.
Okay.
It was probably 19...
Terrific name.
90... When was... Like 1998 or something
my gosh,
like that.
Yeah.
Anyway, I liked him a lot and we kept in touch. So... I remember when I moved here, I was like, hey, Jack, want to have lunch? And he said, yeah, I'm on the Upper West Side. Come over. And I, you know, I was living in, I don't know, like Windsor Terrace or something. I was
sure.
like, sure, no problem. So uh-huh. I still have that. And I like, you know, one of the great things about New York is there's so many people doing great stuff here.
Right.
So.
Yeah. And he produced Errol Morris's, the one on...
Give me a clue.
No, I will. Well, he was the Secretary of the Defense. Yeah, McNamara.
Fog of War.
Well, you know,
that's the
it's
movie
be
that,
one of those days
that beat me at the Academy Awards.
Sorry.
No, it's fine. I actually was happy because Errol Morris deserved to win an Oscar. He's made so many great films. And
that's
I felt like
that was one he should have won for. It's so rare.
Yeah, I felt that like it would have been impertinent for me to win, so
sure
I was
well,
happy.
How many every year that you just see tons of impertinence at the Oscars because you see all these like iconic filmmakers or actors and they're sitting there in the audience.
Yeah,
some 85-year-old guy who's made for 60 years been making incredible works, and then some new kid.
Yeah, for sure
gets the Oscar, and it's like, all right.
I'm making this long-term movie
mm-hmm.
called The Oldest Person in the World. And what I'm doing, you know, the Guinness record for the oldest person in the world changes very often.
It must,
you know,
yeah, of course.
It's an old person and they die, and another person, usually they're about 115. And so I've been working on this movie for a couple of years where I film each person who has that record. And I'm going to keep doing it for years and years. I'm actually going to do it for the rest of my life. But
you're buried the lead.
What's
this
that?
Is a great...
So I will win an Academy Award for that in 20 years.
I think you will. I think you
and
will.
Then it'll be deserved. It won't be impertinent.
Well, okay. The only problem is you can't bring your subjects. Cause
that's true. that's definitely true.
But that's a project along as ambitious as, you know, I'm thinking about... You know, the 7-Up film.
Yeah.
Kind of. It's a similar kind of expansive, very...
Or even Boyhood. Was
Boyhood,
great
of course.
In that way.
Sure, it was. But this is interesting. So how many subjects have you been
I've
following?
Filmed five.
That's
people.
Incredible. Five already?
Yeah.
And you must have to travel the world. right?
Yeah, I just got back. I was in Japan about 2 months ago.
Mm-hmm.
Filmed the current oldest person, who's a woman who lives in Japan.
How does that, now I'm really intrigued, how do you
find the people?
Yeah, how do you hook up? Well, there, I guess the Guinness Book people must
Well,
help.
There's, this being, you know, 2019.
You can email them.
There's a list on Wikipedia of the 50 oldest people in the world, and it's updated daily. So it's easy to tell who they are.
Mm-hmm.
It's harder to get in touch with them because usually they don't have email.
Well, that's the part I figured it would
be. Well, their families, often they have a family who you can access, or with the Japanese woman, she was in a nursing home, and the nursing home
has a phone number.
Yeah, I mean, I hired a Japanese person to help me and set it up.
Okay. I guess there's probably like 2 days of a private detective, a worst case scenario. I mean,
yeah,
where you could, or a private investigator, yeah. Right?
Occasionally, sometimes the family will not want to participate.
How did you, and you just have to like...
There was one person who I didn't get.
Okay.
But she was very short-lived, and Guinness actually never recognized her. There's a whole complicated thing with
being able
to prove it and having the paperwork to prove it.
And if they don't provide that, then...
Yeah, or if they don't provide enough of it...
I see.
You're not the oldest person in the world.
Right. So you started this when?
I started in 2015.
Was that... just recently. So was the first subject local?
Yeah. I started it... I made a movie about the Guinness Book of Records. And it was...
I know.
It was a live cinema piece.
Yeah.
And I, you know, as I performed it over a couple of years, I had to constantly change the oldest person in the world. And I became curious. I sort of started to think about that record and how weirdly fascinated we are with it.
Absolutely.
There's something of like the fear of death in there, a kind of fascination.
Yeah, of course.
But anyway.
It's like that gives us the most hope of then. Like 115, that means I'm still middle-aged.
Yeah, but also, yeah, there's that. But also like, oh my God, I could live to be that old. In a way, it's not, you know, it's not a positive thing.
Well, it depends.
Depends. So I started to think about it. I thought, God, I should make a documentary about this. And then the oldest person in the world lived in Brooklyn, New York, on the L, like several stops down the L. So I thought...
Right nearby.
I have to start.
Mm-hmm.
So I started with her.
Mm-hmm. And she was 116
years
old?
Yeah.
What was her name?
Only one of two people left who were born in the 1800s.
Oh, my God. How many?
Well, there were two.
In the United States or?
In the world.
In the world that were born
in the
19th century?
Yeah.
Oh, wow.
And so then the next oldest person was a woman who lived in Italy, and she was the last person. I filmed her, and now there's nobody left.
Oh, that was born before 1900.
Right.
Wow. That's amazing.
Yeah, it's interesting how it's this constant. They're the oldest person, so they're the furthest back lived experience we have. And when they go, that's it. So now the...
Living testaments.
Oldest person, the current woman, was born in 1903.
So that's before World War I.
Yeah.
Jesus Christ. Right? And
yeah. Way back.
Right, yeah.
Way back then.
Yeah. It's amazing to talk to. And you can have conversations.
Yeah,
so
I mean,
they don't all have to be long. They're just, even if you get one day with them, right?
Yeah.
It's can do what you're trying to do in a way, right? Which is,
it's just a little portrait.
But it makes sense. I mean, we are definitely a lot of people, well, certainly Jewish people, are worried or a little bit, obsessed with the mortality issue. I mean, I know I wouldn't discount or I definitely am. I definitely think of that. I'm thinking about the 116-year-old, and I literally would be still middle-aged. I mean, I guess I'm considered middle-aged in the generic term.
Yeah.
But
you're a teenager.
To be literally.
You're a teenager.
Yeah. My God, it's amazing. So she have the Brooklyn one. Did she have, like, great-great-grandchildren or something? Or?
Yeah, she had a huge... Well, she never had kids, which was interesting.
Oh, my God.
But she... And several of them have not had kids.
Oh,
but she had
that
a very,
explains...
I know.
Longevity.
But she had a very extended, loving family. And in a way, that makes sense. I asked her 82-year-old niece, how did she live so long? And she said she didn't have the two things that kill you, a husband and kids. And
was she kidding?
She was kidding, but there's
it's
also
funny.
Something serious about that. I mean, I have a child now, and I see how you worry about a kid.
Mm.
And that worry ages you, but...
Right.
If you have a family that loves you, but you don't have to worry in that way, It's probably pretty good for your health.
Yeah. Well, that's a great project. We'll have to come back together.
In 20 years.
In 20 years.
Yeah.
You know, when I'll be maybe past middle age. Or maybe I'll just have to come back when I'm a subject in your documentary.
Hey, the thing is with this record, no man allowed. It's never a man.
It's never a man.
Never a man.
It's remarkable. So the oldest person in the world is always
a woman.
As far back as we can.
No, there was a man. Every once in a while it's a man. Like maybe 5 years ago there was a man, but it's just a blip. You know, it's sort of like the opposite of the marathon where men have these great times and all the women are like, you know, a little bit slower. And this is the opposite. It's like the women kick ass and men are, the oldest man's like 2010 or something like that.
Meaning that...
Or I mean is 110.
110.
Yeah.
That makes more sense. Okay. But that's pretty remarkable.
Yeah.
And it is double my age. So I
have a
I'm fine.
Only halfway there.
I'm not greedy. I'll take 110. I'm not to be 116. I'll complain when I'm 110 and I'm dying. But I didn't make it to 100. I could be the
oldest man doing a podcast.
Except I may be already there. Now that I Well, keep me on your mailing list. This has been a lot of fun.
Yeah.
I appreciate your putting up, because normally I'm working at the disadvantage that I haven't been to one of the shows.
Yeah.
But I'll rectify that the next time we have a New York show.
Yeah, April.
In April, perfect.
Yeah. April 25th.
Okay. Which is going to be with the... is it going to be at the Kronos?
Yeah, at Town Hall.
Okay. I love that place.
Yeah, I love that place,
too. I've seen a lot of shows at
That's a storied
beautiful
venue.
Yeah. I took my kid to his first live music there, I think.
What'd you see?
It was this band, like a family, very family-friendly pop, you know, folky pop band called the Weepies.
Uh-huh. Huh.
They write these. It's a husband and wife,
mm-hmm.
and they're really super talented, actually. Huh. And the songs are they're adult. Like, you know, they're about love and about quirky people and, you know,
uh-huh.
typical stuff that people go, things that people go through. It's not intended for children, but it works
for kids
because they're not like, you know, they're not trying to be like rock and roll or you know, like it's just this, and the songs are very very catchy, know, and well written and very well crafted. You know,
there's a great Penn and Baker documentary, Town Bloody Hall, that takes place in Town Hall.
Mm-hmm.
So I was really happy to be doing a show there, kind of just because of that.
Oh, yeah, right. Oh, that's the one with... That was
Norman Mailer.
Where he gets... He's like... He's challenging all these feminists on the stage.
Yeah, he's attacked by feminists.
Yeah, who gets thrown to the floor?
Forget. Somebody.
Yeah.
Well, somebody's like making out on the floor. Just the whole thing, it turns into a... Just like a spectacle.
Right. I remember that. It was a great... It's all archived.
Yeah.
Yeah. Again, thank you. This has been terrific.
Thank you.
I hope we achieved. I think it was, this is kind of achieved for my purposes anyway. So we'll get this up. And then, of course, as April comes up and, okay, that makes sense.
Yeah.
We could do that.
Or whenever.
Yeah.
I'm not that precious about it.
Great. Thanks again.
Thank you.
My pleasure.
You know, when we think of a string quartet, we usually think of four elderly gentlemen. That's not what the Kronos String Quartet is all about.
Kronos began to play the music of Jimi Hendrix. As a result of playing Stravinsky. We have not created the bulletproof piece of music that can wrap its arms around us, that it can protect children, it can protect families. I believe it exists in the universe because I can imagine it. Kronos is trying to play that piece. That's our job. I want to be ready, and I want Kronos to be ready for that next adventure.
The homepage, which was shot, I think, in 1996 and 7 or so, over a couple of years back then, in the late 90s, is the story of pioneering personal blogger Justin Hall. set during a pivotal, transformational year in his life and in the early life of the internet. The documentary was a big hit at Sundance that year. A great opportunity for a young, emerging documentary filmmaker like Doug Block at the time. And it would go on to have its broadcast on HBO. So a lot of people saw it. Doug would come back with similar successes with his subsequent films, 51 Birch Street, The Kids Grow Up, and 112 Weddings. He's back now again with a new film he's working on, but in the meantime, Homepage is available on iTunes and on DVD, and we are glad to bring Doug Block, friend of FilmWax Radio, back for his third visit right now here on the show.
Everywhere I went, I kept hearing about this great new thing called the World Wide Web. It's going to change the way we get information, they said. Change the way we relate to each other. It's going to change everything.
Well, I don't know if you're planning on talking to this guy, Justin Hall. He is a cyber star.
I realize I don't even talk to my friends that much about what's going on in my life. The web is my outlet. I went through 9 years of psychotherapy. I have a lot of experience talking about myself, largely with myself.
Being intimate with Justin, it is a problem, and he exposes every aspect of the relationship.
Put in your sex life?
There's graphic explanations.
Is that what happened in your case?
A bit.
I discovered you with The Kids Grow Up. That was when I first met you.
Oh,
was
really?
With that film.
Oh, it wasn't 51 Birch Street?
No.
Huh.
Interestingly, I went back and watched it.
Okay.
But yeah, so we haven't known each other quite that long. But I remember Homepage being something that came up in the earlier conversations. This is our third time. This is the third time you've been on, because you came on once with Michael Rosato Bennett, right? Not that long ago.
Yes, a very memorable one. This will be a much more sober, reflective interview.
I hope so. That's the idea. The film, which you made in 98?
Homepage.
Filmed
in 96.
Okay.
It edited, you know,
fundraised,
edited, and then premiered at Sundance in 99.
Okay.
Thus, the 20th anniversary.
Okay, so it did. So, Sheila Nevins put it on HBO, correct? Was that after that?
Yeah.
Or, okay.
I mean, world premiered in January 99 at Sundance. It did.
Right.
It had a very unusual.
Yeah.
I would dare say revolutionary distribution initially.
Tell me, because the distribution has changed so dramatically. Yes. in the last 20 years.
I'm probably the first idiot to ever do a free online streaming of his movie before it opens theatrically in theaters. The week it was set to open at Cinema Village here in New York,
I was going to ask you that next.
It streamed on iFilm for free. We gave like a one-week free streaming. And at the same time, it was going out on selling on home video, to the point where, like, that week Roger Ebert made it his video pick of the week on Ebert and Siskel show. Yeah.
When you say home video, you're talking about like on VHS?
VHS at the time, yes. DVD wasn't even around in 99, I don't believe.
It was right around that time.
Yeah.
So, and I'm sure not every film was on DVD,
right,
even though it was a new format. But
right.
Yeah. That's just remarkable. So it's interesting, between your distribution experience with Homepage, your first feature documentary, mm-hmm. right? And the time and the subject matter, rather, of the film, of the documentary, it's like you're actually dealing with and actually on the cutting edge of all this technology that's going on.
Yeah.
You know, if you watch the film, I'm surprised when people even say the word online as a term. Like, it seems like...
Back then?
Well, in my memory, I don't remember these terms being developed so early on,
right.
You know, but your film gives context. Do a little bit of a synopsis as well as... and talk about
well,
it?
Well, it was 96. It was, you know, essentially the third year of the web.
Right.
And I was really fascinated by email and, you know, which was a new thing back then too. And
sure.
It was clearly changing the way we interacted as humanoids.
right.
You know, just the speed with which a relationship could like fire up and, you know, the back and forth nature of it. I thought was really fascinating. And then what people were doing online seemed really, really new and different and revolutionary and full of potential. And so in 96, already thinking I might have been too late to the party and missed the boat and whatever other cliche I can think of about, you know, mm-hmm. not being in early enough.
Not being an early adopter. Or...
thought I would set out to explore this medium of the internet. And, I set out to find whoever might be doing the most interesting stuff on the internet. And I wasn't interested in who was going to make the most money or make the best potential, you know, commercial use of it. So I gravitated almost immediately to these things called homepages, now known as blogs, you know, but it didn't have that term yet, and we didn't know quite
personal,
how to define it.
Personal info.
Homepages,
right.
Online diaries.
Right, whatever
a
you
lot of
call
things
it.
Fell under that rubric. But there are sites like, let me see, Todd's Gallery of Pathetic Human Regret. Days and Nights of Me and My Dog.
Yeah. Because, of course, we didn't know what the internet was going to become. We look at it now, and one way to look at it now is to see it in your film, how crude these sites were, even though they were staggeringly new and world-changing at the time. And no one can take that away. What I really admire about watching the film is how perceptive you were. And maybe it was just all on instinct, or maybe you just... new, I don't know, but
maybe I'm just a perceptive guy.
Maybe you are, and that's what makes you a good documentary filmmaker and storyteller. But here's the thing: what the film does, again, it's called Homepage, is that it really shows how early on people were willing to put it all out there, to bare themselves,
yeah,
and to be intimate and to give up the privacy. On some level, it showed, at least in it's a different way than now when we're putting in our personal information. It's being taken and used for nefarious, you know.
Well, people are willingly putting it up now.
That's right.
I think...
But it was just to say that the film, it's like this early sign of so much that I don't see how you could have known.
Well... there were certainly hints that this is the way, you know, things were going and heading. I mean, I couldn't foresee Facebook or Twitter or Instagram or any of those
social media
platforms where they made
YouTube.
It so simple for you to do it. I mean, back then,
even YouTube was years away.
Yeah, you had to know coding and you had to, you know, really know your stuff technically. You had to understand HTML.
Right.
And, and that's why a lot of the early cyber stars were web designers, interestingly enough. You know, they had to know how to build the site. Then along came software eventually that made it really easy to put up blog posts. I was very drawn to these personal sites. You know, some people were sharing quite significantly, you know, intimate details about their lives, but some were better.
And then we're going to draw the connection to you as a filmmaker, because
There is that. But, you know, some were far better at it than others. I mean, not everybody's life was interesting, and certainly not everybody could write about their life in an interesting way. And when I came across Justin Hall, you know, this kid, a 21-year-old Swarthmore College student, who everybody kept telling me, you know, had the most fascinating sight. I kind of knew I was onto something, that, you know, what I was looking for was somebody who personified the internet, who kind of lived it and looked it and whose mind raced at the speed of the internet. Mm-hmm. And then I took one look. I met him and took one look at him, and his hair cascading up to, you know, mm-hmm. 3 feet in the air and down. Right. I kind of knew I'd found my main subject.
Yeah, it's interesting. He, Justin Hall, who's, you know, if you just Google him, you can learn a little bit more about him, because he is like an early star of the internet. And he, in person, he is somebody who seems to enjoy attention, mm-hmm. and seeks it, but he's also hiding. You know, there's this dual thing that's going on, where on one hand you can be autonomous, or anonymous rather, because you're hiding, there's no person there, but on the other hand he's putting all of his life out there and on his homepage and publishing it for the world to see.
He was trying to create intimacy in a very public way.
Yeah, I mean, that's really the dichotomy I can't quite...
Well, it was the central conflict that I found so interesting. I mean, mm-hmm. he wanted nothing more than to find, you know, some relationship that was, you know, where he could be completely intimate with somebody. And yet he was doing something that made it pretty much impossible for him to achieve that, which is he would write about whoever he came in contact with, and whatever they did together or said together was fair game mm-hmm. for his blog. And some people didn't appreciate that, and some people weirdly really appreciated that.
Yeah.
You know, I filmed a scene early on where one of his girlfriends on campus talked about being, you know, sort of fodder for his cyber art, and admitted that she would go on his site, you know, every day to read about mm-hmm. the status of their relationship. And I asked her if she wanted to go on. I like have this scene of her going on, trying to find out what Justin had written about her that day. And I just remember thinking at the time, this is really weird. I mean, I can't imagine somebody has ever shot a scene like this in a film before, because
no,
it's such a new way of interacting with this new medium. And now, you know, what's so interesting is looking back from a perspective of 20 years mm-hmm. to see how commonplace this is. Every day we go on, who's liking my thing, and who's saying something nice about me, or what are they saying yeah. about me here, or what, you know, what's my feed? It's astonishing how someone who is so far ahead of his time that he, you know, he kind of put off significant amounts of people with what he was doing, is where the culture is now caught up and, you know, kind of left him in the dust.
Lest we forget, this is still a Doug Block film, though, mm-hmm. even though there was no such thing until this was made, unless you're...
Well, it was second film I made.
Your second film.
The Heck with Hollywood.
The Heck with Hollywood, that's right. Film. Was that a feature, too?
It was a feature, but okay. It was not a personal documentary.
Okay, all right.
All
right, so this kind of established, let's say, what a Doug Block documentary is. We now know it.
Yeah, that's where I stuck myself in it.
Yeah, yeah. And, well, also, other part of... the film, which is also, I think, pretty prescient, is that you looked at also how overwhelmingly attractive that being online was, mm-hmm. and how it would create compulsions in many people, you know, and you brought in your family in that aspect of that,
right.
with your daughter, who even says that she prefers going online to TV, you know,
yeah.
you know, and then, and also your wife Marjorie's in the film.
Parents
and your parents yeah. and your father's another one who also got sucked into the vortex, as it were.
How that all evolved, because I never went into it with the intention mm-hmm. of either being in it or any of that stuff. But
so was the idea was it going to be more of a verite look?
Yeah, I mean, look, I didn't even have
expose like
a fully formed idea going into it. I
again all instinct.
Well, I have the advantage of my background is as a cameraman. Mm-hmm. I mean, I'd done some editing, and then I transitioned over to camera work, and that's how I was making my living at the time. And, you know, I knew how to shoot as a one person crew. So I could do things like set out to explore a subject like the internet and what's going on here and what's the most interesting stuff going on. You know, I just sort of had this vague notion that I wanted to find the beating heart of the internet.
Mm-hmm.
You know, when I kept notes to myself back, you know, when I was making it at the time, it was, you know, to me, that was sort of the central premise or directive to myself. Find the beating heart of the internet. You know, what's the human element mm-hmm. of the internet? You know, and at the same time, of course, explore what the internet and computers were doing, you know, mm-hmm. to, you know, change the way we communicate as humans. So I don't know that I had a stylistic directive. Mm-hmm. I did know that it was going to be kind of first person, that I would be behind the camera in a stronger yeah. way than the heck with Hollywood. But I didn't know that I was going to throw my family into it or even be on camera much. But what happened was, Justin,
yeah, figure it was you
him. You know, it was a combination of him, you kind know, of constantly talking about how easy it is. You know, his motto was HTML is easy as hell.
Mm-hmm.
And he really, he was always proselytizing for mm-hmm. people putting up their own online blog. And, and genuinely felt if we all shared our stories, you know, wherever we were, whatever our age, wherever we lived in the world, you know, that, you know, we would forge this, you know, miraculous understanding of each other just by having the opportunity to share our stories and go back and forth in dialogue with each other. It was a very idealistic notion that gets, by the end of the film, disabused by Carl Stedman of Suck, who is mm-hmm. the voice of prophecy that, mm-hmm. you know, hey, we may not all like each other. You know, and it's, you know, we're different. We have differences, and the internet isn't going to dissolve our differences. It's not going to revolutionize the world that way. In fact, it may even just be a platform for people to express their divisive viewpoints, which, you know, couldn't be more true.
Hmm.
Anyway, I decided at some point in the film, actually the scene is on camera, you know, I'm over at Swarthmore and Justin's in the computer lab and we're just kind of horsing around and showing me how to do HTML. And I sort of decide, okay, I'm gonna put up my own blog because I wanted to know what it was like mm-hmm. for him. You know, what mm-hmm. was that experience of putting up your thoughts onto the internet where and sharing it in this kind of public way? What would happen if I did it? And I really didn't want to make it personal. Mm-hmm. Certainly not to the extent that Justin was. As fabulous as my sex life was, I didn't think I would, you know, it was a good idea to mm-hmm. share that with the world.
Was this like an early version of humble bragging? Was he also just strutting and showing off? Like
it was everything. I mean, he was just throwing everything out there.
Mm-hmm.
And he was a good writer, and okay. you know, he had a stylish writer.
Oh, he was really good.
And okay. you know, I wouldn't have followed him if mm-hmm. he wasn't, you know, a serious person underneath
sure.
it all. You know, and I mean, he was brilliant.
He was
a brilliant guy and funny and charismatic and witty and just good company,
quick.
You know,
yeah, right.
perfect camera subject.
Right.
Anyway, what happened was I decided for this blog of mine, which I immediately called the D word, you know, I would keep it focused on the documentary. You know, D stood for documentary, but it also stood for Doug.
Mm-hmm.
And it would be the D word being my word on documentary. I really kept it focused on the experience of making this film, Homepage.
Mm-hmm.
I don't know if I was the first, but if not, I certainly didn't know anybody else, any other filmmakers who were doing this. I know later on filmmakers started keeping blogs about the making of the film while they were doing it. I took it very seriously. Like every week or two, I would put up a long blog post, and I would I would just talk about where we're at. You know, if we're, you know, funding issues coming up, you know, how, you know, just trying to figure out what the story was with Justin. Sure. And what was interesting about that was filmmakers never wrote about the making of their films unless it came out and was successful. It was always vantage point of, well, there's no real suspense because we wouldn't even be reading about this if your film wasn't you know, successful enough to be coming out and opening in some theater.
Mm-hmm.
So I thought, well, this will be really interesting because I don't know how this will turn out. You know, I think it will be good. I think it's a good idea. I think it's an interesting idea. But, you know, there's always those points in a filmmaker's process where you kind of forget why this was even a good idea to do it. You can't see the forest for the trees. And it's like, what was I thinking? And, you know, will I ever get funding? And why am I up till 3 a.m. writing about this when I should be sleeping and making the film? And why did I think doing a blog at the same time was a good idea? All the insecurities and anxieties that come up while making a film, I thought, you know, that will be my own self-revelation. You know, Justin can talk candidly about his personal life. I'll just talk about, you know, candidly about the making of the film.
Mm-hmm.
And by the way, not all just the anxieties, you know, also what's great about making, what's exciting
what's
thrilled me, the joys and angst of making films. And I really wanted to direct it towards other, you know, documentary filmmakers in specifically, but filmmakers in general. You know, we all go through, indie filmmakers, you know, go through very much a similar process. So I thought, you know, in real time, that would be great. And Justin kept going, like, he kept, like, telling me, you know, put it this way, inevitably it got more personal. I couldn't help it, you know. I mean, it was over a 3-year period, and you know, it's hard to raise. You know, Lucy was 6 when I started the film, 9 when it came out. So, you know, she's going through a very formative period and she's very curious about the internet. And I was, you know, tell stories about her. And, you know, as my blog got a little more personal, actually, what Justin predicted happened. He said, the more personal it gets, the more attention will be paid to it, the more people will discover it and like it. People really like this sharing of personal stuff. And it was true. You know, the more personal the blog became, at one point the New York Times contacted me shortly, you know, like in year 2, and said, we're doing this whole new section on technology. And we find what you're doing with your blog and film very interesting, and we'd like to do a story about it.
Mm-hmm.
And I thought, wait a second, you know, normally you kind of wait until your film opens before having your big New York Times article. But I just thought, you know, this is all so new and different. I should just go with it.
Mm-hmm.
I mean, let's just, if these things happen, let's just go along with it, even if it defies the norms of movie making convention.
Right. And so, in other words, you're 2 of the 3 of the production, you're saying that the New York Times, you had already been working on the writing in this blog, the D Word, for a year
point,
or so.
At this point, I'd filmed, you know, I'd filmed almost all of the material.
Mm-hmm.
I'd edited a 9-minute sample that got HBO's attention, and then ultimately Arte, ZDF Arte, and a French German co-production there. And we were just, you know, starting to edit. And meanwhile, you know, I'm blogging all along about this, and they picked up on it, and we go, all right, you know,
your timing as emerging as a documentary filmmaker coincides with the birth and the explosion of the internet. So it's you're known as this early generation of personal documentary filmmakers, but I see that part of your pioneering, if I could be so bold, is actually the D Word. I mean, that's right there with it.
Well, the D Word led to, I mean, the D Word influenced the film becoming more personal.
Yeah, which influenced your whole sort of approach to filmmaking, at least for the next few films.
Sure. Well, some really interesting things happened. Because the people I was focusing on the film, it wasn't just Justin, it was some of his immediate circle, friends, mm-hmm. colleagues, mm-hmm. But all these kind of outliers, you know, they had successful, notable websites, mm-hmm. But a lot of them were, you know, geeky web designers, and, you know, they weren't exactly normal people, you mm-hmm. know, it wasn't like being on Facebook now where everybody has something up. And I just thought, wow, they're all gonna, if all I do is show them, they're all gonna seem normal after a while because you have nothing to contrast them to. Mm. That's when I thought of, I guess I must have spent the weekend at my parents or something mm-hmm. and found them noodling away at the computer or something. And I just thought, you know, my family, they're all just beginning to get into email and the internet. Mm. You know, I asked Marjorie when I interviewed her, the first question is, you know, what do you, you know, what is the internet? Mm-hmm. And she's going, well, I don't know. You know, I have to go back to these notes I took when I took that course, but I think it's like this interwoven network of,
yeah.
you know,
definition was actually pretty good.
Yeah, but we were all
everybody's
just
trying to
starting
find
to
language,
figure it out.
Yeah, to just to make sense out of it, and to, you know, make order of all this. That, I mean, that's,
and Lucy took to it like a duck to water because she was seven
yeah,
at the time.
That's right.
So so anyway, I just thought, okay, that's an interesting contrast, and something really something happened that really stuck with me after the film came out. You know, went to Sundance, you know, it was very exciting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, I thought it was well received. I knew it was going to be on HBO in the fall, and we were, you know, it would be what it would be. But, you know, I was really happy with the presentation of Justin, how he came off in the film. I thought he was like such a really interesting documentary character.
Yeah.
And I remember going the film after Sundance, it went to Rotterdam. And my friend Wendy Lydell, who was a distributor mm-hmm. at the time, was over there. And I remember asking her, "What, you know, did you see the film at Sundance?" "Yeah, what do you think of it?" "Well," she goes, "your main character was really off-putting." I went, "What?" You know, I just was like shocked.
Yeah, right.
And she says, "But your family was great." I said, "What? Are you kidding?" You know, I was like doubly shocked. And years later, when, you know, I was just thinking about doing 51 Bird Street, you know, that all came about as some weird, long story accident. You know, I wasn't really even filming the movie until my father was selling the house. It was 2 weeks away from the movers coming mm-hmm. and leaving the house. I mean, it was that far along. And I remember the moment when I decided that was a film. I asked him if he missed Mom, my mother, who had died the year before. I mean, he quickly remarried a former secretary, and they were, you know, they sold the family home, about to move down to Florida. "Do you miss Mom?" He goes, "No." And in that moment of shock, I remember not only thinking, wow, you think you know your parents, but you have no idea, and realizing what a universal idea that is. I remember having shot footage with my mother, so it wouldn't just be my father telling the story. And I remember Wendy Lydell saying that my family was interesting. I'm thinking, wow, somebody thinks my family's interesting. Mm-hmm. And, you know, so, you know, it went from this idea that I'll use them simply as a contrast to these, you know, far more interesting characters doing this fascinating stuff on this new medium called the internet, to, you know, actually thinking I could make a whole movie about my family mm-hmm. and people would connect.
Mm. Yeah. I mean, even your subject, so, I mean, Justin was kind of like all about read the blog, you know. It's not about me. It's not about me. Is, you know, he's more interested in attention to what he's writing, in a way. Don't you think?
Where is he now? I think he was in, well, he's in San Francisco now.
Okay.
And married, has a 2-year-old kid.
Uh-huh.
And he's a
middle-aged
guy. A budding entrepreneur, and I say budding because his company is bud.com.
Mm-hmm.
They are a cannabis delivery service. You know, mostly in the Bay Area, but servicing all of California.
Mm.
And so he's had bud.com as a URL since 1994. Said Budweiser made him a $50,000 offer years ago that he turned down, figuring it would be worth more someday.
Well, see, you can't get more prescient than that.
Nope. anyway, you know, the other moral of this whole story is at the end of the distribution phase of homepage, you know, after 3 years of blogging endlessly about, you know, my own experiences making the film and then getting it out into the world and frankly, getting quite tired of it, you know, being on this, you know, virtual soapbox. I was talking with a friend who knew a lot about virtual communities, and I had learned some filming with Justin working with Howard Rheingold, who literally wrote the book, The Virtual Community. And, you know, we were just talking one day in the fall of 99, and I said, you know, documentary filmmakers would make a really, really good virtual community. I mean, they're generous about sharing information and experiences. It's not dog-eat-dog like I perceived the fiction world to be. You know, people go into documentaries not expecting to make, you know,
less
become famous or make a fortune.
So less competitiveness and, you know, gravitating towards being secretive and all that.
Plus, I, you know, here I was living in New York City and still feeling like, you know, I made the film in relative isolation. Well, how must people who are well outside of a city or in, you know, some small country somewhere where there's no film community whatsoever, what must they feel? And so, yeah, this friend of mine just said, well, you know, we can actually lease out a little sub-community from Howard Rheingold. We could have it up tomorrow. It wouldn't cost much at all. And I said, let's do it. And the next day, the D word was born, reborn as a virtual community. And here we are 20 years later. We now have over 17,000 members from 130 countries. And it is by far the most successful documentary community online, but one of the more successful virtual communities going. So that is like, you know, every day I'm astonished that this came out of that kind of whimsical conversation, but it wasn't, you know, it was something that built up over the 3 years of making the film.
Yeah. So it wasn't, you had time to kind of figure it out and think about how this could work and be appealing to people and why it might be a real sort of thing.
Well, after 3 years of keeping a blog where I, you know, tried to inspire and depress other documentary filmmakers about the process, you know, I figured why not let filmmakers inspire and depress each other?
and that's
what we've been doing for 20 years.
And now it's 20 years, as you said, and the film is going to, for the first time, be available as through a conduit of its own subject matter, which is, it has not been available through streaming on demand until now.
No. In fact, it hasn't been available at all. You know, once it aired on HBO and did its little 1-week run in
Cinema Village here in New York City.
Cinema Village. It was streaming online for free at iFilm.
And then we had a home video run
where we got, you know, to be Roger Ebert's video pick of the week as we were opening in the theater and getting our, you know, movie reviews. It was an odd form of distribution that I don't really recommend. But, you know, talk about collapsing windows. I mean, I've obliterated the windows.
Yeah, I've heard of other similar type of weird things along my journey here.
Anyway, you know, at that point, after it did its little 1-year run on HBO or Cinemax or whatever outlet HBO was, you know, showing it on, that was it. You know, I mean, the home video run didn't really last because the company folded Big Star, I think they were called. In fact, if you tried to order it, Roger Ebert gave out the, you know, the phone, the URL where you could order it. And apparently anybody who tried to order it online got notified that it was out of stock.
Okay.
So I don't think we actually made any videos, home video sales. Mm-hmm. I have a box of VHS tapes that I'm, you know, happy to sell off. Right, collector's item.
Exactly.
But no, people have asked over the years, you know, I kept getting emails like, where can I find this homepage? I've heard about homepage, or I saw it back in the day and always wanted to see it again. And, you know, I thought for years, I thought, oh, you know, one of these days, you know, one of these years I'll put it up and, you know, but, you know, I was always busy with films and it didn't seem like the right time, but the 20th anniversary of both the D Word and the film seemed appropriate. And, there's just been so much this past year about the internet and privacy and what has, you know, so many think pieces about what is the internet done to us, that I thought it'd be a really interesting time to have this look back at what the early days of the early promise of the internet was.
Right. And so how can people see it?
Well, it's on a bunch of different online platforms. Probably the easiest way is just to go to iTunes. Mm-hmm. And I think it's today is the...
As we record this.
Yes, we record it. It's the 15th. It's going to be available starting tomorrow, the 16th.
Okay, great. So, and then this will be up 2 days later on Thursday. So,
it will be immediately available. Just go to iTunes.
That's right. You can go to iTunes right now.
Right. Listeners. I think the easiest way is go to homepageofthemovie.com. And then we have the, you know, we have the buttons that take you right to iTunes, where it's selling on iTunes. It's also going to be on DVD, and that's at Amazon and other places.
Sure.
I mean, I can't, you know, I can't remember the whole list, but it's a lot of different places.
And your other films are, of course, available in the same manner, in same formats, pretty much.
Yes, they are.
At this stage, widely available.
That's just go to your local search engine.
Right. And pull out your credit card.
Really? I mean, it's so interesting because I can never quite figure out why certain films do better than others online. Like both 51 Bird Street and The Kids Grow Up, you know, two different films about my family, are on iTunes through Cinedigm, the distributor. And we get these royalty checks, you know, every quarter. Mm-hmm. And the royalty checks for The Kids Grow Up are like $1.72. And 51 Bird Street is uniformly getting somewhere between, you know, somewhere around $1,500 a quarter, and has been for years and years. And it's like, why? How?
Algorithms, my friend.
Algorithms. I don't understand these algorithms. It's like, what is it? Your dead parents are more interesting than, you know, your cute little daughter. I mean, it's like, I don't get it. You know, it's I mean, it did very well.
Everybody has annoying parents. Not everybody has cute little daughters. That might be part of the connection that people have to that film. And it had, I don't know. There's a rationale for it. And you know, it's a you know, also a momentum thing. You know, some things take off and then they just always are big, and then other things.
Right. Well, we'll see about homepage. I mean, I didn't have the money to do a real launch, you know, do a lot of publicity around it. Yeah. And but I didn't want to just put it up on YouTube or something like that either.
No. Yeah.
You know, we got, I was surprised at the interest from distributors. This company, Passion River, picked it up. And
Passion River, wow.
Yeah. And there's been a lot of interest in it. Good. I mean, I think, you know, for one thing, you know, Justin has become quite a notable historical figure. I mean, the New York Times, is no less, has called him the founding father of personal blogging.
For sure.
You know, and they were all, you know, so many of the figures in the film that were, you know, that I got to through Justin, went on to have really influential early sites. So it's, you know, it's both a kind of really interesting time capsule of the early internet.
Yeah.
But it's, I mean, it's really interesting to see where we are in order to kind of measure up where we've come to.
Sure. Yeah. That's what I was trying to get to at the beginning of the conversation in a way. Like, just because it's so, it's just a, it's a striking document to you know, it really does make you really think about just how far we've come.
Well,
you know,
it was interesting that even in just the year I filmed following Justin, so much had changed. I mean, even within the film itself, you get hints of what the, what
the internet's going to turn out. Just by the fact that your dad was, you know, emailing and your mom was saying, you can't, no, we're not getting a newer computer. But just how quickly, like the technology was moving so quickly.
Right.
I mean, you know, there just there was no way of keeping up with it. It took a really long time until broadband became, you know, just a, I don't want to get too far.
Well, also, Carl saying that the people doing the most interesting stuff on the internet are now being sucked up by, you know, Time Warner and corporate companies.
The early corporatization of tech. And it didn't take very long.
The early web heads are being exploited and getting cracked wrists, it was it was so interesting because the year it played at Sundance, 99, I think Homepage was, you know, a little bit ahead of its time.
Mm-hmm. So that year, you're the only film on the subject. And then
year was the year of startup.com.
Oh, which was, of course,
City, the main street was lined with Winnebagos of .com companies giving out their swag and goodies.
Right.
You know, I think where the waves come in, I was just as the wave was going down and the new one was about to come in and, flood us all.
Right.
It's really been fascinating to re-release it and just see the, the reviews and articles about it have been like uniformly great, which is...
And you're on Filmworks really Radio again, for God's sake.
Well, I have a tendency to make a film and invest, all this time and energy, years of my life into it, and then you move on. Mm-hmm. You go on to the next thing. I tend not to look back. Mm-hmm. And this is the first time I've looked back at something that I made many years ago, and it's very gratifying because... at least for me, I set out to make films that will be timeless and universal, that you can see 5, 10, 15 years later, and it'll be every bit as interesting a film and will hold up as well as when you first saw it. What's different about Homepage, I think it's actually far more interesting now than it was then.
Makes
just
sense.
Because of the historical, nature of... looking at this medium at a very early stage.
Yeah.
So.
Exactly. Again, Homepage is available on I'm going to say most major streaming platforms, probably most conveniently iTunes. Check it out. And we'll do this again, for any reason, of course, but certainly by the next film, your next project.
Great. Thanks.
Thank you.
It's kind of what the web is there for, is that kind of experimentation and play.
But how would you feel if you were going out with someone like Justin and you actually had
I'd censor him.
So it sounds like your home isn't a physical one.
I really do live most on the net, but whatever I was doing, I think I would still crave, some idealized, intimate relationship.
I said, well, what brings you here, Justin? Justin looked at me with a big smile on his face and said, the opportunity to work with you.
When you pay rent, you don't get a family, but here I get a family, Family comes with the rent. I love that. I'm getting in on the ground floor as one of the most intense moments, the week before launch, when you're living on pizza and Jolt Cola and staying up late, hacking all the time.
Justin has a mission to go teach all these people, okay?
Imagine if all your relatives had web pages and all their relatives had web pages and some of your dead relatives had web pages telling stories about back before you were born.
I think that he's gotten away with a lot of stuff. I haven't had to punch him in the nose about it, but he definitely pushes the line.
You're a very high maintenance relationship.
Tribeca is starting up in a couple of days. We have so far lined up already a few friends of the podcast, including old friend Marshall Curry will be back. He's made a number of documentaries, but he's back. He's got a narrative work he's showing, his first work of fiction, and it's going to premiere at the Tribeca Film Festival. We also are bringing back to the show Davey Rothbart, who a number of years ago co-directed a documentary with Andrew Cullen. We had them both on, and it's been a number of years. I'm glad to bring Davey Rothbart back to the show. He's a very popular podcaster himself. He has a podcast and a magazine called Found. I'm sure many of you probably have heard of it. And Davey will be back. 17 Blocks is the documentary. It looks amazing. It's getting a lot of great buzz. And we'll have Davey back on the show. And then finally, we're bringing back friend of the podcast, Mark Weber, who was on just maybe 2 years ago, if that. And he's already back with a new film. It's called The Place with No Words. It's in the series of, I guess he has this special style where he shoots with friends and family, and he casts them in these movies and himself. So this is the new one, and it's going to be premiering at Tribeca, and he's going to be back on the show. And there'll be others. We'll have more people, too. So we're going to have on Monday, let me just tell you, we're going to have a special episode, where the first in a series of partnerships with the Vermont College of Fine Arts film program. We're going to bring on one of their alums. And then in May, we'll bring on another one. And then in June, the last in this series of filmmakers who come out of that program and who are going to share their experiences with us. I have a long history with the Vermont College of Fine Arts Film Program, and I'm proud to bring them back. Is a sponsor and a partner. Stay tuned for that. And then we will be bringing you dispatches from the Tribeca Film Festival. And then about a week or so later, we're going to be at the Montclair Film Festival doing interviews there. And then after that, at the Maryland Film Festival. So lots to look forward to on the festival circuit. Until then, though, I think we are going to say farewell and take care of yourselves and the ones you love. Until next time. Broken lines, broken strings, broken threads, broken springs, broken idols, broken heads. Broken games.